Hello, and welcome to your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And happy Thanksgiving. Belated, I think, by the time you get this, but it's Thanksgiving today when I'm recording. My name is Jan Heineman. Today I'll be reading to you from the Rochester Beacon. And our first story from the Rochester Beacon comes from writer Alex Holly and is dated November 26th. New ways to think about pie. Rebecca Vang has always been pretty business savvy. After growing up in a Hmong community in California, she moved to Las Vegas early in her adulthood and shortly thereafter began a career in marketing research and brand development. Yet, when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, she and her husband found themselves searching for a change of lifestyle, setting their sights on upstate New York and shifting their eyes to a new prize, or one may say, pies. We wanted to make a change for ourselves, and that's how we ended up in Rochester, says Vang. Now, after 4 years, a permanent move across the country, and the birth of her first child, Vang is celebrating her bakery, Crust Pie Company's first storefront location at 133 Gregory Street in the South Wedge neighborhood. While the store opened in late September, Vang's vision of starting a pie shop began almost 10 years ago. Her ambition to bake? Rather simple. It's really hard to find really good pies, Vang says. The only time you really find pies is at the grocery store and around Thanksgiving, right? So, Vang decided to take matters into her own hands, crafting pies for family and friends around the holidays. It became something that I became very passionate about and pretty good at, and it got to the point where I started thinking about what would happen if I started to actually try to sell this product, she says. Dealing with a lot of personal woes ourselves, I decided that the best thing for myself was to maybe start a business and really learn how to cherish and love the work that I was doing. After quitting her job on the West Coast and moving to Rochester in 2021, Vang and her husband set full steam ahead on opening Crust, first by vending at the Brighton and Fairport farmers markets. After initially operating at the commissary, a local shared commercial kitchen, Vang and her team of five moved production to Gregory Street to meet storage and time demands. Now, over 2 years later, Crust has a retail location, countertop on one side, kitchen on the other. One huge reason for the delay is because we moved here when I was 7 months pregnant, Vang laughs. I have a type A personality, so my ambitions were much larger than the reality of what we could do. That's not to say that Vang's time commitment has grown any less. Along with managing her business, most weekends have her coming to the shop at 3 a.m. to begin production for the day. I mean, those are the difficult parts, she says. But the easy parts are where you start noticing real appreciation in the products that you're providing. Those kinds of things make a big difference. At the end of the day, Vang's pies are a labor of love. As the main creator of Crust's recipes, many flavor combinations are adapted from family favorites, travel recollections, and pieces of her own culture as a first-generation Asian American. Desserts like Crust's peanut butter and jam fluff pie tie in favorite flavors from Vang's husband and his grandfather, while the salted caramel apple pie highlights seasonal flavors and produce from local vendors at the Fairport Farmers Market. Likewise, Vang leans into pie's adaptability as a medium fusing dishes like bolognese and Japanese curry into savory pies and amping up classics with new flavors. For instance, her addition of nutty black sesame into a classically composed banana cream pie. One of Crust's fan favorites, a Vietnamese coffee pie, first began as a collaboration with the Asian American and Pacific Islander owned coffee shop Winter Swan, spinning its rich coffee brew into a delicious custard to complete Vang's signature buttery crust. Partnerships like these align with Vang's larger ambitions with Crust, sharing new flavors and pieces of her heritage with the community around her. "I always say," she says, "there's nothing more American than pie. And blending my culture and Asian American influences with what we do, I love doing that because it really speaks to a part of who I am. I want to continue to be a pillar of the AAPI community, so being able to infuse the flavors that I grew up with and things that are popular right now too, I'm really proud that we can bring that to the table and bring that to customers here who may not be familiar with it. People are actually engaging in conversation with us when we're sitting at the table," continues Vang, "with the other metaphorical seats filled by customers, fellow small business owners, and the community. And of course, according to her, they're all eating a slice of pie." Crust Pie Company's storefront location is located at 133 Gregory Street and is open weekly on Fridays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. and Saturday and Sunday from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. If you're looking for a dessert for the holidays, more information can be found at Crust's website, Instagram, or Facebook. And Crust's website is crustpieco.com. That's crustpieco.com. This story from the Rochester Beacon comes from writer Alex Holly, who's a contributing writer and a member of the Oasis Project Second Cohort, which is their internship program. And you're listening to readings from the Rochester Beacon on your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our next story from the Rochester Beacon comes from writer Gary Craig and is dated November 25th. Oak Hill's boardroom dispute heads to trial. This article is a post in a partnership between the Rochester Beacon and veteran reporter Gary Craig, who you may remember from the DNC, featuring articles published on his Substack site. Whether the Oak Hill Country Club wrongly ousted a board member doesn't really matter, lawyers for the club argue. Why? Because the board member, retired businessman Eugene Baldino, is alleged to have resigned before the board's action. Yes, the topsy-turvy lawsuit embroiling the venerated country club, home to past and future major golf tournaments, continues to get topsier and turvier. And this lawsuit, one I wrongly predicted over a year ago would surely settle, is now on the eve of trial. Thousands of pages of court documents have been filed in the proceeding. Divisions with the country club membership have become inflamed, and over the past year, the club's own reputation has been tarnished and burnished. Tarnished by the allegations of animal house-like behavior among some of the club's wealthy members, and burnished by its recent choice to host the PGA Championship in 2035. The latest legal volley, with claims that Baldino chose to quietly resign from the board, has its own animal house resonance. Is there triple secret probation in the Oak Hill code of conduct, if you know, you know. Probably over $1 million has been spent on legal fees by the parties, and those costs will surely balloon with the forthcoming trial. Club insurers have said they will not cover the defense, so club members may well shoulder the costs. The trial is scheduled to begin Monday, December 1st, presided over by State Supreme Court Justice Daniel Doyle. It could last a week or more, likely more. Doyle has set aside December 1st through December 22nd. I plan, this is Gary Craig talking, to attend a good portion of the trial, though I do have conflicts for some days. I have filed a photo request for photos for the trial's start and should know something this coming week. If it's approved, it's likely my friend and former colleague, photographer Jamie Germano, will join me. Jamie and I both retired from the Democrat Chronicle in recent months. I also wonder whether this will be the first request in New York, if not beyond, for camera presence at a court proceeding on behalf of a Substack user. Resigned or jettisoned or both? Over the past week, attorneys for both sides have filed pretrial reports, highlighting the arguments they plan to present at trial. The country club, along with some of its board members and senior employees, are being sued, and three different law firms are providing representation. One is used because of a conflict for a past board member. The country club attorneys contend, significantly, the court need not even reach the issue of the validity of the board's vote to remove Baldino on June 18, 2024, because prior to then, he had already resigned. That's coming from the country club attorneys. The club has maintained that it ousted Baldino because of rude and ugly behavior to a club dining manager, a claim that the club employee, Hannah Halpin, says has largely been manufactured by the club. She, too, is suing O'Kill. The board alleges that Baldino resigned on May 21st, 2024, and it was approved by a 13-2 board vote. Baldino, the club lawyers say, later tried to, quote, renege on his resignation, unquote. Baldino's lawyer has maintained that there was no written agreement about any resignation, court papers show, and that the process to remove him breached state laws for nonprofit boards. The O'Kill attorneys say the process was proper and legal, even if irrelevant after the supposed resignation. The discussions of a possible resignation apparently came during settlement negotiations, which never led to a resolution. How did it get this bad? The central issue in the lawsuit from Baldino and four other club members is the vote to kick Baldino off the board and whether it was legally proper. That can seem like a narrow and arcane question, and in many ways it is. Nonetheless, the lawsuits spiraled into allegations of fiscal malfeasance, crass behavior, not only on the part of Baldino, but also other O'Kill Board of Governors members as well, and allegations that one board member may have tried to coerce a key witness with a payment. Kelly Foss, the attorney for Baldino and the other petitioners, wrote in court papers, "Indeed, the O'Kill Board has previously determined that far more serious allegations against other governors merited no disciplinary measures whatsoever. Such disparate treatment serves as proof that the board's underlying decision was arbitrary and capricious." Baldino has insisted that the board was not exercising fiscal oversight and that the club's finances needed to be better monitored. He was elected to the board with a pledge to tighten the fiscal reins, his supporters have said. Baldino's push for access to more financial records and more fiscal transparency is the true reason for his removal, he has argued. Foss writes in court papers that at trial, there will be evidence that Baldino raised questions about, quote, club's finances and suspected mismanagement of discretionary funds, about misuse of club assets, about lack of oversight over executive reimbursements and compensation, and about inaccurate and unverifiable club tax filings. What to expect at trial? The trial will hinge on some of the nuances of state laws that impact nonprofit boards and whether the laws were ignored. But beyond that, it's possible, if not likely, that the allegations of juvenile behavior by some members, drunkenness, anger on the links, churlish conduct toward club employees, will also be part of the testimony. Baldino has been accused of not one, but two boorish interactions with staff, and court papers hint that the club is prepared to offer testimony about the earlier allegation. Baldino's, quote, member file contained a recommendation from a prior board composed of a different slate of governors that he should do something like this again. He should be suspended from the club lawyers said in court papers. As well, the club contends that it had legal advice from a labor council saying that, quote, Baldino's actions created the risk of legal exposure, and council recommended that formal discipline be taken against him, unquote. Gary Craig writes, as I've earlier reported, the board also may have ignored the advice of a member of the board. A lawyer, who also was the board's only woman, that the board might need to pay more attention to state laws before Baldino's removal. The most delicate parts of the trial will likely be the expected testimony of former board president Robert Sansone and Halpin. Club lawyers are likely to portray Halpin as a former employee who has altered her story about the interaction with Baldino and is now misrepresenting it for her own lawsuit. Halpin has maintained that Baldino was not over-the-top rude and that the club clearly and duplicitously tried to use her to oust Baldino. Both Sansone and Halpin were deposed for hours. Sansone knew Halpin from the club, and once, learning that she was having some financial struggles, sent her money, which he has portrayed as a helping hand. This happened during the pendency of the litigation, and Baldino and his allies have questioned whether this was an attempt to sway Halpin and her testimony. It's hard to say how long after the trial before Doyle renders a decision, and it's even harder to predict whether thereafter the losing side appeals and opts to spend hundreds of thousands more. This story from the Rochester Beacon comes from contributing writer Gary Craig, a retired Democrat and Chronicle reporter. He now writes on Substack. And you're listening to readings from the Rochester Beacon on your Niagara Frontier radio reading service. We have one more story for you from the Rochester Beacon today, coming from writer Narm Nathan and dated November 26th. A climate agenda under strain. Some of Alex Amarese's clients planning large real estate projects are uncertain about the future. Amarese, who sells commercial real estate for CBRE and works closely with local developers, often runs into the power challenge, whether it's in the town of Henrietta or the city of Canandaigua. Either there's not enough electricity to power a new project, or developers are told it's likely to dry up. Amarese, a Rochester Beacon board member, says, "I have clients that are scrambling to put building permits in place so the power remains allotted to them. I've seen developers that I know who are basically at a standstill for projects because the power is no longer being allotted." His experience illustrates a challenge that has affected climate advocates and economic development officials alike. New York's inability to outline targets for climate reform has left many in limbo. The sweeping mandated targets for renewable energy generation and greenhouse gas emissions reduction by 2030 have placed unrealistic pressure on the state's Department of Environmental Conservation, experts say. Achieving them will result in high costs to consumers and hurt economic development. Dennis Elsenbeck, an attorney and the head of energy and sustainability at Phillips Lytle LLP, says, "A move to an electric economy misses the mark if we do not have the electric capacity on our electric transmission and distribution systems that has been prepared for growth, as capacity is a strong selling point for those seeking to locate and or expand in New York. Manufacturers interested in New York seek a reliable energy supply at a fair market price." In two separate reports, the energy planning nonprofit New York Independent System Operator, or NYISO, last month detailed the challenges of maintaining a reliable high-voltage electric system as electricity transmission faces limitations with growing consumer demand. While the reports focus on the downstate area, they highlight a concerning future as the state works to comply with climate reform targets outlined in its Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. After a few years of pushing a climate agenda, Governor Kathy Hochul made no mention of it in her State of the State address this year. Now, a state Supreme Court judge has ordered the NYSDEC to issue draft regulations previously proposed by Hochul and mandated by the state's Climate Act. Climate reform. The CLCPA builds on existing state legislation, establishing mandated targets in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and increasing renewable energy generation. It created a Climate Action Council to develop a scoping plan that would allow the state's Department of Environmental Conservation to develop and implement a framework that would, first, reduce greenhouse gas levels by 40% from 1990 levels, and second, ensure that 70% of statewide electricity be generated from renewable sources. New York's Climate Act went into effect in 2020, first giving the Climate Action Council 2 years to develop a draft scoping plan that would introduce recommendations for the state. When Hochul took office in August 2021, her legislative agenda in the following years first prioritized fulfilling the Climate Act's targets through sweeping investments in renewable energy infrastructure and the electrification of buildings. In her 2022 State of the State address, Hochul announced plans to build 2 million climate-friendly homes by 2030, along with a $500 million investment in offshore wind infrastructure to power downstate areas. After the Climate Action Council advanced its scoping plan later that year, Hochul then directed the DEC to develop a cap and invest program focused on affordability, employment opportunities, and investment in disadvantaged communities. A cap and invest program would set an annual limit on greenhouse gas emissions statewide, requiring producers to purchase allowances if they expect to exceed the state's cap. By lowering the emissions cap each year, producers would either be required to purchase increased allowances or divest from greenhouse gas emissions. Graham Hughes, Policy and Advocacy Director at Climate Solutions Accelerator, a regional climate action group, says, "In cap and invest, large polluters have to buy the right to pollute. They do this through participating in an annual auction in which an allowance is auctioned off. The money that's raised through this auction is then reinvested into communities across the state to do everything from building thermal energy networks to retrofitting homes, even just making people's energy bills more affordable." A study on cap and invest price ceiling scenarios by nonprofit research institution Resources for the Future shows that a low price scenario in which allowances are set at $14 in 2025 and raised to $30 in 2030 would generate $6.6 billion in revenue toward the Consumer Climate Action Account. This account was established by the state to receive 30% of all cap and invest revenues to mitigate consumer cost increases that could arise from the Climate Act. Low and middle-income households, according to RFF, would reap net savings through a statewide cap and invest program. After the DEC and the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority issued a pre-proposal outline for a cap and invest program in December 2023, the state's next steps were to draft and circulate enforceable regulations that would align the state with its climate reform targets. As mandated by the Climate Act, draft regulations were to be issued and enforced by January 2024. Those regulations, however, have not been released. Hughes says, "There's the large polluters in the fossil fuel lobby who stand to pay more money under a cap and invest program, so I'm sure their lobbying is at least a factor in this. We really don't know why Hochul and other leadership at the state level have not really shared publicly why these delays are happening." Unclear objectives. In her 2025 State of the State Address, Hochul said that the DEC and NYSERDA would, quote, "take steps forward on developing the cap and invest program, proposing new reporting regulations to gather information on emissions sources, while creating more space and time for public transparency and a robust invest planning process." New York Renews, a statewide coalition of climate advocacy organizations, started the Fund Climate campaign in response to continued delays in cap and invest, calling on Hochul and the state to issue mandated draft regulations. Advocates claim these rules would not only further align New York with the Climate Act's mandated targets, but directly serve disadvantaged communities through overall decreases in energy costs. The DEC has identified areas throughout Monroe County as communities that bear increased burdens of climate change. Local advocates point out Rochester is facing the third highest energy burden in the nation. Michi Wenderlich, campaign and policy coordinator at Metro Justice, says, "We see this really as a betrayal to our community, because this is billions of dollars a year that polluters, not taxpayers, would pay for things like upgrading all of our homes and training workers to do that work. It's core things that help all of our needs in the intertwined housing, affordability, utility bill crises, and health crises that we're seeing, and of course the climate crisis. She's just walking away from this cap and invest money." In March, a select group of advocacy organizations within the New York Renews Coalition moved to sue the DEC over repeated delays in the draft cap and invest regulations, alleging a violation of the statutory requirements of the state's Climate Act. The DEC, represented by State Attorney General Letitia James, stated that the agency has released greenhouse gas reducing regulations while acknowledging that a cap and invest framework is still being developed. According to the DEC, concerns about consumer affordability and statewide grid capacity are the primary constraints to achieving the targets set by the state's Climate Act. In a supplemental letter to Ulster County Judge Julian Schreibman, the agency stated that a mandated 40% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 would be infeasible without unanticipated costs to ratepayers. The only target the state is expected to meet under its Climate Act is to develop 10 gigawatts of distributed solar infrastructure by 2030. Its Climate Act dashboard states it has achieved 23% of its emissions reduction goal and 35% of its renewable energy production target. The most aggressive policymaking the state could enact to meet its mandated targets, the DEC maintains, will raise economy-wide costs for the state's energy system in 2040 by at least 35%, or $42 billion for that year alone. An old problem. Worries about the state's ability to meet its climate targets existed long before the court's October decision. In an August 2023 review of renewable energy, State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli revealed the state's existing renewable generation could not adequately meet Climate Act targets without significant development. DiNapoli wrote, "To meet the CLCPA 2030 renewable energy goal, the state will have to more than triple the installed 2022 renewable capacity of roughly 6.5 gigawatts by adding an additional 20 gigawatts over an 8-year period. As a point of reference, the state added 12.9 gigawatts of total electric generation, including both fossil fuel and renewable sources, in the last 20 years. Clearly, achieving the renewable energy goal will require an increase in recent performance." For Elson Beck, an original member of the Climate Action Council, the concern lies not just in availability, but in the length of time needed for the New York State Independent System Operator and local electric utilities to study capacity that is more reactive than proactive. Elsenbeck says, electric capacity was a challenge when the CLCPA was written in law, and it was not covered adequately during the Climate Action Council deliberations that were too consumed with transitioning away from natural gas. As we've seen recently, the electric system continues to be challenged today and will continue in the foreseeable future if we do not embrace the needs of local economic development, work with interested developers, and seek a more proactive electric plan that prioritizes economic growth. A July 2024 State Comptroller audit found inadequate planning, monitoring, and assessment of risks and challenges in the State Public Service Commission's efforts to help the state meet Climate Act targets. At times, the PSC used outdated data and wrong calculations to determine if the state could reach 70% renewably sourced electricity by 2030. The PSC, Napoli says, did not develop a backup plan should those targets not be met, even though only 30% of large-scale renewable projects were completed from 2005 to 2023. Those concerns have culminated in the NYISO's findings of short-term reliability violations downstate because of the deactivation of large-scale fossil fuel peaker generators, indicating the state does not have the capacity to sustain the approach toward the Climate Act targets. For Justin Wilcox, executive director of Upstate United, a nonpartisan fiscal policy coalition, said an all-of-the-above approach must be reflected in the law. Wilcox says, it's simply not realistic to think that we can move forward with an all-of-the-above approach, which includes natural gas, when the law effectively outlaws it. The fact that we can't add more fossil fuel generation has put us at a bit of a bind because we're losing generation faster than we're able to replace it. Continued delays in implementing the law, Wilcox adds, do not provide a level of certainty needed for continued statewide economic investment. Wilcox says, if you're going to delay implementation, even though it says otherwise in the law that was written in 2019, what is an investor or a company who's looking to make capital investments in New York State left to do? Are they to assume that because the governor is saying all of the above and kicking the can down the road in terms of releasing regulations, do they assume that's the state of play? In ruling in favor of the plaintiffs, Judge Schreidman ordered the DEC to issue draft regulations that comply with the Climate Act no later than February 6, 2026, giving state legislators 1 month after they return to Albany to evaluate potential amendments to the Climate Act. Elsenbeck and Wilcox both describe an ideal statewide climate agenda as one that balances the concerns of climate advocates with the infrastructure realistic and certain enough to generate long-term economic investment. The fate of the Climate Act lies largely in lawmakers' hands as they evaluate what New York can do to advance climate reform through the existing CLCPA or another route. For Assemblymember Josh Jensen, Achieving the 2030 Climate Act targets would disproportionately place burdens on upstate and western New York to benefit downstate generation without valuing local and upstate communities. Jensen, whose district includes parts of Monroe County, says, "I do not disagree with the idea that government should work to prioritize creating a more sustainable energy and environmental future. However, I do not believe strict mandates are the means to achieve that future. Those accelerated timelines will make our state less affordable for families and businesses and jeopardize the availability of energy on the grid." Democrats in the Assembly have reaffirmed their support for climate reform, whether through new legislation or potential amendments to the CLCPA. Assemblymember Harry Bronson joined Hughes and the Climate Solutions Accelerator in calling on Hochul to sign legislation that would repeal previous requirements for utilities to connect natural gas lines to new construction within 100 feet of interested customers. Assemblymember DeMond Meeks says, "The recent court decision underscores the importance of moving forward thoughtfully on the state's climate commitments." Assemblymembers Jennifer Lunsford, Sarah Clark, and Brian Mankletoe did not respond to a request for comment. Neither did Senators Pamela Helming, Robert Ort, or Samra Brook. Meeks says, "As we return to Albany for the legislative session, I remain focused on ensuring New York takes the necessary steps to meet its goals, while keeping the needs of our communities at the center. Even as state resources become more challenging to manage, we will continue working toward a balanced approach that supports families, strengthens our economy, and prepares our state for the future." For State Senator Jeremy Cooney, the Climate Act targets remain at the forefront of his priorities. Cooney says, "Everything should be on the table to examine how we obtain the funding necessary to implement the provisions of the CLCPA, and that's exactly what we'll be looking at as we prepare for session next year." Says Elson Beck, "If we do not balance economic and environmental sustainability, both may fail. And when the cost to achieve policy initiatives negatively impact manufacturing production, there is a high probability of repealing a law that has good intent but is not economically sustainable." This story from the Rochester Beacon comes from Alex Amarese, who's a Rochester Beacon board member, and Narm Nathan, who's a Rochester Beacon contributing writer and a member of the Oasis Project's inaugural cohort. Malak Kassem, a member of the Oasis Project's second cohort, assisted with the article. They're both interns, former interns, on the Rochester Beacon's internship program. And you have been listening to readings from the Rochester Beacon on your Niagara Frontier Radio reading service. My name is Jan Heineman. Thanks for listening today, and please do come back and listen again to the Rochester Area Podcast on your Niagara Frontier Radio reading service.